It read, "The nation's war cry, forward to Richmond, forward to Richmond. The rebel Congress must not be allowed to meet there on the 20th of July. By that date, the place must be held by the National Army." So the armies were gathered up and sorted into their camps, where they waited in the rising summer heat for politicians and generals to decide exactly who would strike first and when the blow would fall. There was a strange, dreamlike quality to these weeks of waiting that many soldiers commented on. Except for the diseases that seemed inevitable when soldiers were crammed 20 men deep into white canvas Sibley tents, life for the Southern soldiery on the Alexandria line was not so bad. It could even seem languorous. "The country people are all staying at their farms and are now cutting wheat, and the darkies in the old red hills look as natural as can be," wrote young officer Edward Porter Alexander to his wife on July 5, 1861. "The country girls come around here every morning to see the parades, and it looks a good deal like West Point." The war still seemed distant. "I candidly do not believe that any attack will be made on us for at least a long time," Alexander wrote, "nor that Beauregard intends to advance on Washington within a month at least." 30 miles away across the Potomac, their Union counterparts, many seeing a big city for the first time, had become earnest and enthusiastic tourists. They tromped through all the public and government buildings, including the Smithsonian, the Post Office, and even the White House. The most popular place of all was the Patent Office, which displayed a large array of the latest gadgets and inventions. Those were the more tame diversions, anyway. The streets, badly cut and rutted by army wagons, now teemed afternoon and night with drunken, quarrelsome troops. Hotels and boarding houses were filled to overflowing. Soldiers jammed the saloons, slugged down juleps and gin slings and whiskey skins and brandy smashes, and brawled in the streets, often brandishing revolvers and bayonets. Sanitary conditions were nightmarish. The Washington Canal, running through the middle of the city, became an open toilet, a receptacle for all the city's sewage, human, equine, and otherwise. It all found its way to the Potomac, and according to a government report, spread out in thinner proportions over several hundred acres of tidal flats immediately in front of the city, the surface of which is exposed to the action of the sun at intervals during the day, and the miasma from which contaminates every breath of air which passes. The stench was everywhere, inescapable. Thus, the men waited for their unimaginable war. They would not wait much longer. Johnston's army, meanwhile, was rapidly becoming the key strategic pawn in the looming battle that, at its core, as with all Civil War battles, was a numbers game, one played with both real and imaginary figures. McDowell knew that he had about 35,000 men in four roughly equal divisions. He estimated Beauregard's strength at 35,000. This was grossly inaccurate, as many early war assessments were, particularly by Union generals. Beauregard had barely 20,000. But McDowell's number nevertheless dictated strategy, and in particular one excruciatingly obvious piece of that strategy. If the numbers in Manassas were going to be roughly equal, then, at all costs, Johnston must be prevented from joining Beauregard. And it was equally true that in Confederate war councils, where they were absolutely aware of their strength along the Alexandria line in front of Washington, and their likely disadvantage in number of troops, number of regular army soldiers, and ordnance, there was a growing conviction that Beauregard could not win without Johnston. With the fate of the nation apparently hanging on the whereabouts of Joseph E. Johnston, what followed in the Shenandoah Valley in the second and third weeks of July was one of the great military blunders of the Civil War. It very likely altered the course of the war, and in any case profoundly changed the lives of Thomas J. Jackson and his Virginia Brigade. It starred Major General Robert Patterson, a 69-year-old Pennsylvanian who had fought in the War of 1812, had been a major general of volunteers in the Mexican-American War, and later became quite wealthy as the owner of cotton mills and a sugar plantation. Though he was brilliant at business and prominent in the politics of Pennsylvania, what he experienced at the head of an army in unfamiliar country with massive supply requirements and an enemy of unknown strength was more like paralysis. It was Patterson who had moved timidly with his army from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, to occupy and abandon Harper's Ferry on June 16, and Patterson, whose forces had crossed the Potomac River from the Maryland side on July 1, and then engaged Jackson at Falling Waters. The Confederate force had then fallen back again, while Patterson marched unopposed into the town of Martinsburg, announcing by wire to Winfield Scott that he was in hot pursuit of Johnston. But instead of driving south to meet the enemy, Patterson now paused to wait for supplies. He would not attack before he was certain that he had absolutely everything he needed. "As soon as provisions arrive," he told Scott, "I shall advance to Winchester and drive the enemy from that place, if any remain." He would do no such thing. Patterson, as would soon be apparent, was scared. He was in enemy territory in Virginia and surrounded by a hostile populace. His supply lines were implicitly threatened. He worried, above all, that he did not have enough men, and this worry took the form of an uncritical willingness to believe the most wildly exaggerated reports about the size of the enemy's force. How, he wondered, could he be expected to bring his 18,000 men against 26,000 men in enemy territory? At Martinsburg he waited, and urgently requested more troops, which Scott sent to him, 5 regiments. Still, Patterson dithered and worried. He complained about lack of transportation, about the 90-day enlistments that were soon to expire, making the men unwilling to fight, and again of being in an exposed position in enemy country. He worried that the reason Johnston did not attack him was that Johnston was luring him into a trap. Had Scott himself not warned him a month before that a check or drawn battle would be a victory to the enemy, and that he should attempt nothing without a clear prospect of success? Patterson, an old warhorse, was not necessarily afraid of violence. Like so many inept generals early in the war, he was afraid of the responsibility, and of the shame and embarrassment that would follow any defeat or disaster that had resulted from his orders. His attitude is worth noting because it would become so common among general officers on both sides. It is visible in Patterson's hedged response to Scott, who was trying in late June to coax Patterson to cross the Potomac into Virginia. "I would not, on my own responsibility, cross the river and attack without artillery, a force so much superior in every respect to my own," Patterson wrote, "but would do so cheerfully and promptly if the general-in-chief would give me explicit orders to that effect." In other words, he would happily sacrifice his army if only Scott shouldered the responsibility. It was all about blame. On July 16, Patterson, goaded by Scott, finally ordered a reconnaissance in force of Johnston's army, which had by now fallen back to the town of Winchester. Patterson had been told that McDowell was marching that day on Manassas, and so the purpose of this demonstration was to make sure Johnston and his Confederate force did not go anywhere. That was the main idea, prevent the 2 Confederate armies from uniting. So a small body of Union infantry and cavalry went forward and briefly engaged Colonel Jeb Stuart's cavalry. But Patterson, now only a few miles in front of Johnston's smaller force, suddenly became frightened by reports that Johnston had 30,000 to 40,000 or even more troops in front of him, with 60 pieces of artillery. Patterson and his officers reasoned that since Johnston had already been prevented from joining Beauregard, why risk fighting? So instead of advancing, they retreated. On July 17, 18,000 Union troops marched 7 miles back to Charlestown near Harper's Ferry, the Potomac River, and the soil of Maryland. That night, Patterson received a wire from an impatient and exasperated Scott in Washington who did not yet know that the cautious Pennsylvanian had retreated. "Do not let the enemy amuse and delay you with a small force in front, whilst he reinforces the junction, Manassas, with his main body," said Scott, who evidently still expected Patterson to move against Winchester. Patterson was behaving badly, and he knew it. When he was advised by a staff member that if he did not move against Winchester, he would be a ruined man, and that in the event of a misfortune in front of Washington, the whole blame will be laid to your charge, Patterson summoned up his courage and decided that he would advance the next day. Incredibly, he lost heart again. He never moved. He gave many reasons for this, chief among them that parts of his army, whose 90-day enlistments were up and who were weary of the promised advances that never happened, would not serve an hour past their time. Unfortunately for Patterson, Johnston's troops, under orders from Beauregard and with Jackson's brigade in the vanguard, were already marching toward a pass in the Blue Ridge Mountains and to the train depot that lay beyond the mountains, on their way to fulfilling Winfield Scott's worst nightmare. Patterson and his officers, in their secure camps in Charleston, saw none of this. That was because Jeb Stuart, executing one of the war's first great cavalry screens, had rendered him blind. While Johnston and Jackson slipped away, Stuart's dashing horsemen were thrown forward between the two armies to create dust and confusion and general mischief and to make sure no Union scouts got through. Scott, increasingly suspicious, now demanded angrily of Patterson, "Has Johnston not stolen a march and sent reinforcements toward Manassas Junction?" To which the hapless, doomed Patterson replied, even as Jackson was marching, undetected, east toward the mountains, "The enemy has stolen no march upon me. I've kept him actively employed, and by threats and reconnaissance caused him to be reinforced. I have accomplished in this respect more than the general-in-chief asked or could well be expected in face of an enemy far superior in numbers." He soon discovered how disastrously wrong he was. He finally acknowledged this 2 days later in a telegram to Scott. With a portion of his force, Johnston left Winchester by the road to Millwood on the afternoon of the 18th, he wrote. His whole force was about 35,200. Patterson could not resist a final lie, and one with phony filigree to boot. The 200 made the false intelligence sound precise. It was only a portion, moreover, because Johnston left 1,706 soldiers behind in Winchester. In any case, the war was over for Patterson. On July 22, Scott ordered him relieved of his command. Jackson had struck his tents and marched through Winchester and out the other side of town while a frightened and disheartened citizenry looked on. He hated to leave them. He had fallen in love with Winchester, and now believed that he was likely abandoning it to the enemy. For his 2,600 men, who had not been told where they were going, the orders to move out were the worst thing they had heard yet. After a full month of retreating and then languishing in their disease-ridden camps, they were skulking away from the enemy yet again. As they moved out along the long, dusty, winding pike toward the looming blue haze of mountains, they chafed and grumbled. Then, an hour and a half out of Winchester, under orders from Johnston, regimental adjutants read them a communique. "General Beauregard is being attacked by overwhelming forces. Johnston has been ordered by the government to his assistance. General Patterson and his command have gone out of the way to Harper's Ferry and are not in reach. Every moment is precious, and the general hopes that his soldiers will step out and keep closed, for this march is a forced march to save the country." The reaction was immediate and thunderous. "At this stirring appeal, the soldiers rent the air with shouts of joy," Jackson wrote to Anna, "and all was eagerness and animation where before there had been only lagging and uninterested obedience." They waded across the waist-high Shenandoah, arrived at the small town of Paris, 6 miles from the Piedmont station on the Manassas Gap Railroad, at about 2 o'clock in the morning. They would take the train to Manassas Junction the next day. The exhausted men slept. Jackson, meanwhile, joined the other sentinels and kept watch. The next day was remembered later by many soldiers as one of those sweet, soft intervals that occurred in the early days of the war, before the fighting began to take its fearful toll. Because there were not enough trains and cars to transport the troops all at once, some of the regiments had simply to wait their turn, passing time in the pleasant countryside until mid-afternoon. "We had a regular picnic," recalled John Kessler, a member of Jackson's brigade. "There was plenty to eat, lemonade to drink, and beautiful young ladies to chat with. We finally got aboard, bade the ladies a long farewell, and went flying down the road." Actually, they labored down the road behind a single struggling locomotive. The 34-mile trip took a full 8 hours. But the rumbling, snail-like pace had at least some benefits. Along the way, crowds gathered to wish them well. Ladies waved handkerchiefs, and food was handed through the windows. The picnic was not quite over. As humble as the journey was, Jackson's brigade was engaged in one of the first large-scale transfers of soldiers to battle by railroad in history. Chapter 7. All Green Alike. How astonishing, at first glance, that this unprepossessing little patch of ground in the middle of nowhere was something that large numbers of men would fight and die for. Jackson and his brigade arrived at their destination in the early evening of July 19, 1861, having first been packed into freight and cattle cars like so many pins and needles, as one man put it, then carried on a rattling, bumping, and excruciatingly slow journey into a nondescript northern Virginia country of wheat and cornfields and pastures, broken by pine woods and farmhouses that suggested prosperity, but not wealth. The land was, in all ways, unexceptional. So was the little knot of frame buildings, a tallow factory, telegraph office, hotel, and a few railroad workshops, scattered around the depot where the soldiers of the 1st Virginia Brigade detrained and stood awaiting orders, gazing about as though to gather in the significance of the place, or its relationship to the glorious battle they were going to fight. They were a motley group, as unimpressive to look at as their brigadier. Some wore gray uniforms, some wore blue. Some wore what looked to be civilian dress with a bit of military trim. They sported a bewildering variety of hats and carried mostly outmoded smoothbore muskets. They were Jackson men all, some of them former students from VMI or neighbors from Rockbridge County, drilled to the limits of their patience in camps from Harper's Ferry to Winchester, bent to the will of their surprising new master, and tested exactly once in the brief fight at Falling Waters. Though they did not look like much, in a young war full of puffed-up amateurs, they passed for a well-trained fighting unit, and Jackson was extremely proud of them. The hot, flat crossroads where they now found themselves, 30 miles west of Washington, D.C., would, within 2 days, become one of the most famous places in the Western world. It was called Manassas Junction. There were exactly 2 reasons why anyone cared about the little junction that summer. First, it marked the point where the 148-mile-long Orange and Alexandria Railroad, the principal north-south line of Virginia, crossed the Manassas Gap Railroad, a 77-mile-long line that linked the fertile lower Shenandoah Valley with the rest of northern Virginia. This made Manassas Junction the most important strategic site north of Richmond, and the inevitable target of a Union advance. Second, the Confederacy had decided at all costs to defend it. This meant placing its largest army between Manassas Junction and McDowell's Union Army, which had moved west from its camps near the Potomac to the tiny town of Centerville, a small cluster of buildings that included several taverns, tanyards, and a squat stone church 7 miles to the northeast. It had also meant fortifying the land around the junction itself. Trenches had been dug and stockades erected. Amazingly, in the middle of those works was a giant, 3-ton naval cannon that had somehow been dragged into place and would hurl 32-pound balls, though it was difficult to imagine just then at what or at whom such a massive projectile was going to be thrown. Jackson disembarked, obtained directions to Army headquarters, then rode off to receive his new orders. When he arrived, General Beauregard was holding a meeting with a group of pipe-smoking generals and colonels bedecked with an assortment of epaulets, sashes, and sabers, and seated on the shaded lawn in front of a farmhouse belonging to a man named Wilmer McLean. They were deep in conversation when Jackson, unimposing in his rumpled blue VMI uniform and stiff as ever, approached, saluted, and reported that he had just come from the Shenandoah Valley with 2,600 men, the vanguard of Johnston's army. Instead of a warm welcome, or even a perfunctory welcome, from Beauregard, Jackson was greeted with a mixture of shock and surprise, the general gist of which was, what on earth was he doing there? Unbeknownst to Jackson, Beauregard had the day before suggested to Joe Johnston, he could not issue an order because Johnston outranked him, a grand plan of battle in which Johnston, instead of coming to Manassas Junction, would take his army on a wide swing to the north, through the Bull Run Mountains, then head east and fall upon the flank and rear of the Federal force at Centerville. Beauregard, meanwhile, would attack the army in front, creating a vice-like movement that would send the Yankees reeling back to Washington. Beauregard had thought the plan ingenious and was quite pleased with it. Johnston had found it foolish. "I did not agree to the plan," he wrote later, and charitably, "because ordinarily it is impracticable to direct the movements of troops so distant from each other, by roads so far separated, in such a manner as to combine their action on a field of battle, I preferred the junction of our armies at the earliest time possible." The problem was that either he had never bothered to tell Beauregard that, or his message had not gotten through. Beauregard had been describing this ambitious flanking movement to his officers, explaining that Johnston was crossing the Blue Ridge that very day and would attack the enemy's right flank the next morning, when Jackson walked in to announce that a significant portion of Johnston's army, at least, was doing no such thing. And now Jackson was the target of unfriendly questioning. Was Johnston planning to march with the rest of his army on the enemy's flank, Beauregard demanded? Jackson, who was tight-lipped anyway in the presence of other general officers, now replied in formal tones that as far as he knew, such a flanking march was not likely, since Johnston was coming east with his column on the same train Jackson had taken. Beauregard found Jackson so lacking in credibility, such a worthless officer, that he simply refused to believe him. He told the brigadier where to camp his brigade and dismissed him. Jackson returned to the junction and marched his weary men 3 miles through pouring rain to a pine thicket near a creek called Bull Run. Beauregard, meanwhile, resumed addressing his officers, as though this inconvenient interruption had not happened. "The information received from General Jackson was most unexpected," wrote Jubal Early, then a brigade commander, "but General Beauregard stated that he thought Jackson was mistaken, and that he was satisfied General Johnston was marching with the rest of his troops and would attack the enemy's right flank as before stated. He stated that the effect would be a complete rout, a perfect Waterloo, and that we would pursue, cross the Potomac, and arouse Maryland." Jackson was, of course, right. The Creole general would very quickly be disabused of these plans for a second Waterloo. Beauregard's plan had indeed been a bad idea, coming at a time when green armies with neophyte officers could barely execute a 10-mile march at route step on a clear road, let alone a 50-mile turning maneuver through unknown terrain, out of touch with the main body of the army, where the timing of the attacks would be everything. But Beauregard, as it turned out, the dashing hero of the South, the man who had brought Sumter to its knees, was full of bad ideas. On July 14, he had sent an emissary to the Confederacy's First Council of War, held at the Spotswood Hotel in Richmond, where he had presented a plan for a slashing offensive against the North that was Napoleonic in its grandeur and ambition. Beauregard would begin by uniting with Johnston and his 20,000 men. They would fall upon the Federals in front of Washington and, as Beauregard put it, thus exterminate them or drive them into the Potomac. Johnston would then return to the Shenandoah Valley with his original 20,000, plus another 10,000 from Beauregard's army, and destroy the smaller Union army under Robert Patterson all within a week. After a side trip to eliminate McClellan's irksome 12,000-man column in western Virginia, Johnston would turn, march through Maryland, and attack Washington from the rear, while Beauregard assailed what remained of its defenses in front. The result, in what Beauregard confidently asserted would be a campaign of 15 to 25 days, the South would not only win a crushing victory, but would then, in effect, dictate peace to a beaten and bereft Lincoln in the White House. In its breathless optimism and its assumption that the Federal armies would happily cooperate with the Confederate plan, Beauregard's scheme, the product of a restless, energetic, impulsive nature, managed to sound less like a calculated military strategy than something a child might concoct on his bedroom floor with toy soldiers. His proposal was heard by President Jefferson Davis, his military assistant Robert E. Lee, and Adjutant General Samuel Cooper, all of whom found it ridiculously impractical, starting with Beauregard's wishful assumption that Johnston had 20,000 men. This rejection had a larger meaning, too, for the opening gambit of the war. Beauregard's proposal, vainglorious and overblown though it was, had been offensive in nature. But the Confederate approach to this first big test of strength, as developed by Davis and Lee, would be fundamentally defensive. They would wait for McDowell to come out of his camps in front of Washington, then they would protect their land and their country with everything they had. Having been ignored first by Davis and Lee and then by Johnston, Beauregard finally proceeded to do what his bosses wanted him to do, which was to put in place the first large-scale defensive position of the war, an 8-mile-long line made up of the bulk of his 32,000 troops, along the lethargic, debris-clogged Bull Run, which wound, snake-wise, in a northwest-to-southeast arc, roughly perpendicular to a straight line between Manassas Junction and Centerville. It was here, Beauregard had said, that he would make his desperate stand. He had moved all of his troops back from forward positions nearer to Washington, and now his line extended from the Warrenton Pike and its stone bridge on the north, and the Orange and Alexandria's bridge at Union Mills on the south. Between those two points were 7 fords, only one of which was considered easy to cross. On July 18, these defenses had been tested half-heartedly by a Union reconnaissance in force at a place called Blackburn's Ford, and the attack had been sharply and convincingly rebuffed. But neither side had gained any tactical advantage. In any case, by July 20, reinforced by Johnston's brigades from Winchester, including Jackson's, Beauregard had his line fully in place. McDowell, meanwhile, had more to worry about than the constant indigestion he was suffering from eating his multi-course meals. As he saw it, he was being goaded into attacking the Confederacy, quite against his will, by what seemed a vast alliance of howling news editors, congressmen, cabinet officers, rank-and-file soldiers, and Lincoln himself. And he was feeling more and more uncertain about the whole enterprise. His men were simply not ready, he argued. Many of his soldiers had been in the army less than a month, had only the most basic training in such skills as marching and shooting, and were in such poor physical shape that they were likely to wilt in the blazing summer heat and humidity of northern Virginia. For all his inexperience with command, McDowell recognized that no one on either side had ever managed such large numbers of men in a single body, not even the legendary Winfield Scott. This was a new kind of war. Troops would move by train, orders would move by telegraph wire, and tens of thousands of soldiers would have to be moved to, from, and around battlefields. Simply inserting so many regiments into a battle was beyond the ken of even the West Pointers. I had no opportunity to test my machinery, McDowell complained later, to move it around and see whether it would work smoothly or not. There was not a man there who had ever maneuvered troops in large bodies. There was not a man in the army. I wanted very much a little time. All of us wanted it. We did not have a bit of it. The answer from Lincoln was, "You are green, it is true, but they are green also. You are all green alike." If he had been uneasy on the subject of troop management before the middle of July, McDowell was horrified by what happened when, after seemingly endless delay that had held him up more than a week, his men finally marched out of their camps on July 16 toward Centerville and Manassas. The war's first great troop movement had started splendidly. 50 regiments of infantry and 10 batteries of field artillery wheeling about in the hot dust, regimental colors flying, bayonets flashing, and band music rising on the wind. They had marched before the president. There were so many fancy carriages, members of Congress, senators, and fashionable ladies, that it seemed more like the return of a triumphant army than the dispatching of a green and untried one toward an uncertain fate. Still, the army was superbly equipped and commanded by experienced soldiers. The 4 division commanders and 8 of the 11 brigade commanders had been regular army men. The first day's march went rather well. The second, on July 17, was a full-scale disaster. It began with the fact that officers, who did not yet know that the rebel army had withdrawn from its forward positions, were terrified of ambush. They saw non-existent breastworks and shadow batteries in the woods. Stray shots at phantom pickets would prompt the long roll of drums, signaling an enemy attack. That meant frequent stops, and the men quickly learned what frequent stops did to marching columns totaling 35,000 men. The main effect was an accordion-like action on a giant scale that alternately froze men in place in the heat and dust of a miles-long traffic jam or caused them literally to have to run to catch up, sweating profusely while their equipment clanked around them. In the prodigious delays, the men hooted at passing officers, stopped at every creek to fill their canteens, and undertook excursions that involved everything from berry picking to chasing pigs and chickens. They often discarded their packs and even left their cartridge boxes behind. This was a volunteer army, after all. There was as yet no draft. And the men still cherished the illusion that they were individuals, with individual rights and privileges. When the Union forces reached Fairfax Courthouse and saw that the Confederates had abandoned it, they indulged in a celebration so wild one might have thought the war was over. Bands played, stores were looted, and soldiers were rampant in the streets. "Our dirty fingers were plunged into their jam pots," wrote one soldier from Rhode Island, "and we drank their whiskey, tea, and coffee, and ate their sardines and pickles with gusto." It had taken the Federals a full 2.5 days to travel 22 miles, a delay that allowed Johnston to steal his march on Patterson and join his troops with Beauregard's. When they finally arrived at camp near Centerville, officers discovered that the rank and file were out of food. The next day was spent correcting this problem. Saturday was consumed by reconnaissance, the reading of local maps, and efforts to scout a ford over the creek on the far rebel left. All of this was weirdly leavened by the presence of senators, congressmen, and cabinet officers, who hovered about McDowell's headquarters, passing out cigars and delivering opinions on the outcome of the battle. By Saturday evening, after seemingly endless delays for the most astounding variety of reasons had stalled his advance nearly 2 weeks, McDowell's Union Army was out of excuses. They would have to fight. That night, the last night, was lovely, soft and bright, and experienced to the fullest degree by thousands of soldiers on both sides who could not sleep. "This is one of the most beautiful nights that imagination can conceive," wrote one Union soldier from his camp. "The sky is perfectly clear, the moon is full and bright, and the air is as still as if it were not within a few hours to be disturbed by the roar of cannon." In the Union camps, regimental bands played and the men sang the Star-Spangled Banner. One newspaper correspondent, riding through the camp, called the scene the picture of enchantment. That enchantment was cruelly brief. The first of the bugles began sounding reveille at 2 o'clock the next morning. Chapter 8, The Bullet's Song. The first of all maxims for the conduct of a campaign, wrote Edward Porter Alexander, who would later become a Confederate general, and who this day, as a young captain of engineers serving in the Signal Corps, would play a critical role in the battle, is to oppose fractions of the enemy's army with the whole unit of your own. In other words, compel the enemy to divide while you unite and strike him divided. Or, as our General Nathan Bedford Forrest put it in plain Confederate vernacular, get there first with the most men. The outcome of the Battle of Manassas, or as Northerners who liked to name battles after watercourses had it, Bull Run, turned on this very same tactic. In this case, a secret and stunningly successful federal march around the left wing of the Confederate Army. The movement followed the military maxim, bringing a large mass of Union troops to confront a small rebel force. By the late morning of July 21, the Union tactic had created a mismatch so extreme that it should have resulted in the wholesale rout of the Confederate Army and the triumphant arrival that day of the Union Army at Manassas Junction. Richmond, 90 miles away, ought to have been trembling in mortal terror. That the Federals failed to accomplish any of these things, in fact failed so completely and miserably that almost the exact reverse happened, is the story of the first great battle of the Civil War. It is a story that features as one of its prominent heroes an unknown brigadier general named Thomas J. Jackson. All battles take on a logic of their own. In this case, that logic was supplied by the Union forces, since it was their plan that determined where and how most of the fighting took place during the 9.5-hour battle. General Irvin McDowell's scheme was simple in theory, difficult in execution. He had 4 divisions that totaled 35,000 men a few miles from Bull Run in Centerville, Virginia. His idea was to bring just enough force against a few sections of Beauregard's 8-mile-long, 32,000-man defensive line along the creek to occupy its attention and make it think an advance was in the offing, while the main Union column made a sweeping march to the north and west, unseen, under cover of woodland and dale. In other words, so far around the edge of the Confederate line at the Stone Bridge, so far upstream on Bull Run that the rebels would not detect it until it was too late. To create his diversion, McDowell planned to send 2 brigades. A Civil War brigade usually consisted of 2,000 to 2,500 men, though this could vary widely, to Mitchell's and Blackburn's Fords, where they would feign attack, and 3 brigades under Brigadier General Daniel Tyler to the Stone Bridge, the terminus of the Confederate left, where they would likewise lob shells and fire muskets and otherwise pretend that they intended to mount a full-scale assault. Meanwhile, 2 full divisions under Brigadier Generals David Hunter and Samuel Heitzelman, some 18,000 men and 30 guns, would leave at 2 a.m., cross Bull Run at Sudley and Poplar Fords at about 7 a.m., then drive southward. Thus flanked, the Confederates would be forced out of their defensive position at the Stone Bridge, allowing Tyler's division to move west, down the Warrenton Pike and into the fight, delivering the final blow that would send the Confederate Army staggering in retreat toward Manassas Junction and Richmond beyond. On paper, the plan was perfectly sound. Its principal weakness could have been predicted from the logistical horrors of July 17. These green soldiers and officers did not yet know how to march, and certainly not over unknown roads in darkness. Beauregard, remarkably, wanted to do the same thing to his adversary, only in reverse. His mirror image plan was to unleash the forces on the right side of his line to turn the Union's left flank. This was in spite of the curious fact that Beauregard fully expected that his West Point classmate Irvin McDowell was going to hit the Confederate left. But instead of strengthening his forces there in expectation of a defensive fight, the Creole general's answer to the expected Union advance was to beat McDowell to the punch, and do it so effectively that the rest of McDowell's army would have no choice but to break off its own attack. Beauregard had already concentrated the bulk of his force in his center and on his right. Now he would swing them into action, and in his words, by a rapid and vigorous attack on McDowell's left flank and rear at Centerville, rout him and cut off his retreat on Washington. It was an audacious plan, forsaking defense for an aggressive offense. At 4:30 a.m., Beauregard handed his final combat order for approval to Johnston, the ranking officer in the field, who had not yet had time to learn the local terrain. Johnston signed it. All that remained was to give the order to advance. Or, so it must have seemed to Beauregard, peering into the cottony darkness across Bull Run in the early morning hours. The scheme, as it unfurled, was a disaster. No advance was ever made, and the promised tactical movements never came close to happening. The entire elaborate pantomime is noteworthy, mainly because it failed to provide any deterrent to McDowell's own maneuver, and because it is such a perfect example of the almost comical incompetence of Beauregard and his staff. His problems began with the combat order itself, a muddled, contradictory, and occasionally nonsensical document, later famous as the single most confusing order of the war. It had set no time for the attack, confused brigades with divisions, invented two brigade divisions where none existed, and implied that the army would be split into two corps, consisting of those non-existent multi-brigade divisions, each with its own corps commander. The Confederate army had neither corps nor divisions, and would not have a two-corps structure until 14 months later. One of those mythical corps was to be commanded by General T.H. Holmes, though Holmes himself had not been informed of this assignment. There was also the problem of language. Many of the orders were blatantly contradictory. One dispatch to General D.R. Jones, for example, consisted of such atrocious grammar that, strictly interpreted, it actually instructed Jones to attack his Confederate colleague, Richard Ewell. All of this was very bad warfare, but no one had done anything like it before, and there was nothing to measure it against. The generals and their staffs simply blundered ahead, unchecked by anyone who might know better. Soon the reality of Union plans and Union guns collided with this somewhat dreamy world of things as Beauregard wished them to be. At 5 a.m., the Federals opened fire. Nothing in earnest, mostly rolling volleys of musketry aimed at the far bank. But the attack rattled Beauregard, who now began issuing a new stream of orders to answer it. One of these went to Brigadier General Richard Ewell, on the far right of the line, who had originally been ordered to lead off the Confederate advance across Bull Run. Now Beauregard gave him an entirely new order, directing Ewell to prepare to make a diversion against the enemy's intended attack on Mitchell's Ford and probably Stone Bridge. This, of course, superseded the earlier orders for the attack on Centerville. For some reason, neglect or sheer staff incompetence, other generals were not told about those changes. Beauregard was clearly losing his grip, and Johnston, a recent arrival who had been forced to defer to the Creoles' knowledge of the troops and terrain, could do nothing about it. Boree began shifting his brigades to his left, creating even more confusion as couriers rode forth from headquarters with a stream of ever-changing orders. Jackson was one of the principal victims of this, receiving instructions to move in behind three different brigades. At 8 a.m., while thunder from the Federal guns still rolled down the line, and musket fire rattled in the wooded areas at the Stone Bridge and at Mitchell's Ford, the indomitable Creole had one final inspiration. Having strengthened his own left, he now decided that he would go ahead and mount his cherished offensive against Centerville and the Union left anyway. He got approval from Johnston, who must have had some sense of how crazy and chaotic the battle plan was becoming, then issued yet another string of orders, directing brigades under Generals Ewell, D.R. Jones, Longstreet, and Millage L. Bonham to move forward across Bull Run. It was in keeping with everything else that happened that morning that Richard Ewell, who was to lead the advance, never received this order. Longstreet, who had never received the second set of orders issued at 5:30, had crossed Bull Run in obedience of the original battle order and sat there, wondering what to do with himself. Beauregard, meanwhile, waited for his decisive Napoleonic counterstroke to commence. He was waiting and watching at about 9 a.m., listening nervously to the firing upstream of his position, when a courier arrived with a remarkable piece of news. Edward Porter Alexander was a young man when the war started, but he had already had an exceptional career in the Army. Born into a distinguished Georgia family, he had excelled at West Point, graduating third in his class in 1857, and in the late 1850s had helped develop a new signal system for the U.S. Army. The system, sometimes called wigwag, consisted of flagmen waving flags or torches back and forth to create codes that represented letters of the alphabet. Corpsmen would use field glasses to read the signals, write them down, and deliver them to officers in the field. When the Civil War started, Alexander resigned his commission in the U.S. Army to fight for the Confederacy, and by this means both armies came to use the same signal system. Alexander had been directed by General Beauregard to build a signal system that would improve communication within Confederate lines. The slender, bearded Alexander had thus built four stations, a task he had finished less than 2 weeks before the battle. The main one was erected a mile east of Manassas at Wilcoxon's Hill. Others were situated in Centerville, on a hill on Van Pelt's farm east of the Stone Bridge, and at Confederate headquarters at McLean House, behind the center-right part of the Bull Run line. On this still Sunday morning, Alexander's system was going to receive its first combat test. For him, it would be a day of extraordinary luck. That good fortune began in the early dawn. Of his four signal stations, Alexander preferred the vantage point of the station at Van Pelt's, where he had pitched his tent. So he was upset when Beauregard ordered him back to the station at Wilcoxon's Hill, miles in the rear. Unbeknownst to Alexander, as he packed his haversack with the day's rations and prepared to leave, a gargantuan Federal cannon with a greater range than any other Federal artillery piece that fired 30-pound conical rifled shells was being wheeled, by Herculean effort, into place east of the Stone Bridge on the Warrenton Pike, where the Union was about to begin the demonstration that would cover its flank march. At about 6 a.m., the gun was loaded with a percussion shell, which would explode upon impact, and to the great glee of the Federal cannoneers, who believed it was likely to scare the Confederates to death, trained on the most visible target, which happened to be the Van Pelt House, a mile and a half away on the other side of Bull Run. Seconds later, a lieutenant yelled fire, and the historic first shot of the Battle of Manassas went whistling through the still dawn air, over the heads of the rebel troops defending the Stone Bridge, and scored a direct hit. This was so much fun that the Union gunners fired two more shots at the house, each coming to earth in the same vicinity, each with the same satisfying blast. One of those shells hit Alexander's tent, and would probably have killed him if he had not left just a few minutes before in disgust to obey the order he did not want to obey. The second piece of luck came several hours later and was equally extraordinary. After arriving at the station at Wilcoxon's Hill, Alexander began to scan the other signal stations. He soon saw the flags wigwagging from the Van Pelt station and focused his field glasses to receive the message. But as he did so, something strange happened. Somewhere off in the lush green distance, several miles northwest of the Van Pelt house, he saw a little flash of light, a faint gleam indescribably quick. Though the flash was gone in an instant, he knew immediately that he had seen something very specific, as he put it, the reflection of the morning sun from a brass field piece. He had no doubt about what he had seen. But what could a cannon possibly be doing there? Curious, he ignored the wigwags from the Van Pelt house and focused his glass on the spot, fully 8 miles away, where the glint of light had originated. Now he could see, in the gaps of the trees, not only cannons, but the glitter of bayonets, too. There were large numbers of soldiers moving up there, miles from where they were supposed to be. He realized that he was looking at a massive federal flanking march far beyond the end of the Confederate line at Stone Bridge, which was commanded by a hard-drinking colonel named Nathan Shanks Evans and his small force. It was 8:45 a.m. Alexander immediately signaled to Evans via the Van Pelt house, saying simply, "Look out for your left. You're turned." He then wrote out a longer note for Beauregard because the general was not near a signal station at the time. "I see a body of troops crossing Bull Run about 2 miles above the Stone Bridge," wrote young Alexander, deliberately containing his wild excitement. "The head of the column is in the woods on this side. The rear of the column is in the woods on the other side. About a half a mile of its length is visible in the open ground in between. I can see both infantry and artillery." It would seem impossible to conclude from this description of a column so large that a half-mile-wide gap in the woods revealed only part of it, that an enormous federal turning operation was not underway. Amazingly, both Johnston and Beauregard did just that. They decided that though this flanking march was both surprising and worrisome, it was nothing that a few brigades, shifted upstream to the Stone Bridge, could not handle. They continued to wait hopefully near Mitchell's Ford for the rolls of gunfire from their downstream brigades that would signal the beginning of Beauregard's grand, war-ending advance on the Union left. Brigadier General Thomas J. Jackson, camped with his brigade on a gentle slope about a half a mile behind Mitchell's Ford, rose hours before sunrise on the morning of the battle, knelt in his tent, and prayed. He prayed every morning, but on this day, the Sabbath, a day when he normally refused to have anything to do with secular matters, even refusing to write or post mail, he had much to pray for. There was his wife, Anna, whose 30th birthday it was that very day, for whom God's blessing and protections were sought, as always. There were the many benedictions of Jackson's own life, which he never failed to give thanks for, most recently his promotion, which he believed had come from our kind Heavenly Father, and would allow him, as he had written to Anna, the opportunity of serving my country more efficiently. Jackson, deep inside himself, was an ambitious man, and he knew it. Part of the purpose of prayer was to restrain such vanity. And then there was the looming fight. Though we do not know what Jackson said to God in his prayers that morning, his correspondence around that date reveals his frame of mind. It was clear, first of all, that he believed that the outcome of the battle rested entirely in the hands of the Almighty. Mortal men were merely his instruments, vehicles through which his will manifested itself in the world. Jackson believed without the slightest doubt that in his fight against an unholy invader whose object was the degradation of his homeland, God was with him and with the righteous Confederate cause. In this belief, he was not unlike many other generals in the world, before and after him. Jackson's God, moreover, was like the protective paternal God of the 118th Psalm, the 6th and 7th verses of which read, "The Lord is on my side, I will not fear. What can man do unto me? The Lord is on my side as my helper. I shall look in triumph on those who hate me." God and God alone would choose the hour of his death. Since his life was in God's hands, there was no reason to be afraid. Jackson's brigade awoke at about 3 a.m., ate a hasty breakfast, and then fell into ranks in the warm, windless early morning darkness. The soldiers had no idea what they were about to do, where they were to go, or what role they might have in someone's battle plan. The rank and file never did. Those problems were left to old Jack and the high command. For 5 hours, they did nothing but shuttle back and forth behind Bull Run, according to Beauregard's inexplicable impulses. They were impatient. They were hoping that they would be lucky enough to do some fighting before the war was over. Jackson, too, waited. A young artilleryman who had been assigned to his brigade found the general wearing a shabby gray coat and a cap pulled over his eyes, half sitting and half lying against a trunk of a small pine tree. He did not move as we approached. When we reported, only his lips moved with this brief and characteristic order, "When the infantry moves, follow." We had not long to wait. At 9:30, they were ordered to march northwest to the Stone Bridge. They would never get there. En route, Jackson learned from a courier that Confederate troops under a general from South Carolina named Barnard B. were hard-pressed in a fight well to the west of the Stone Bridge. Jackson's men could already hear the noise of battle, which meant that whatever else may have been happening, the true Confederate left was miles from where it was supposed to be. Acting without orders, there was no one around to issue any, and fighting west of the Stone Bridge was in no one's battle plans anyway, Jackson set the men on a brutally fast march. One artilleryman recalled that they were running that distance like panting dogs with flopping tongues, with our mouths and throats full of the impalpable red dust of that red clay country, thirsting for water almost unto death. As they approached the battlefield on a narrow woodland road, with the sounds of musket fire and artillery fire ringing in their ears, they beheld a sight that was both shocking and bewildering. Large numbers of Confederate soldiers moving in the opposite direction, broken, bloody, and in full retreat. Their commands were all cut to pieces, the men told the wide-eyed Virginians. The day was lost. Soon the beleaguered General B. appeared and rode to meet Jackson at the head of the column. "General, they're driving us," he said. The two men knew each other. They had attended West Point at the same time and had fought side by side in the Mexican-American War. Though it is impossible from this distance to know the tone of Jackson's reply or the expression on his face as he delivered it, his words would seem to speak for themselves. "Sir," he said to B., "we will give them the bayonet." The men Jackson saw retreating through the woods were the end product of McDowell's massive flank march, a maneuver that had seemed for hours like a disaster in the making, but had instead turned out to be a brilliant success. The marching itself had been horrific. More than 18,000 men, along with horses, wagons, caissons, and artillery, had hit the road at 2 a.m. and had marched 10 miles in 7 hours, much of it in darkness. Men who had had an hour of sleep, or had not slept at all, stumbled over logs and roots and into brambles and were stabbed by branches of trees they could not see. As on the 17th, the weird accordion-like action happened again, alternately forcing the men to run with full packs to catch up, or to stand stock still, breathing the hot dust, waiting for who knew what log jam in the road 3 miles ahead to be cleared up. In the lulls, some soldiers picked blackberries and even took naps. Heintzelman's whole division, which was supposed to cross at Poplar Ford, had gotten lost, and had ended up merely trailing behind Hunter, lengthening the line and worsening the stops and starts. There was rising heat and great thirst. We scrambled along through the dense woods and thickets, the darkness so intense that literally you could not see your hand in front of your face, wrote one of the men who made the march. They were supposed to arrive in full force at Sudley Ford at 7 a.m., but actually arrived at 9:30 a.m., bone-weary and so thirsty that when they arrived many fell on their faces in the muck of Bull Run, sucking in the filthy water. McDowell had been greatly worried about the pace of his march. He knew, too, that when his troops arrived at Sudley Ford, rebel columns were already moving toward him. But because his maneuver had not been detected until Porter Alexander saw the gleam of a Union cannon at 8:45, McDowell's men now faced only a small Confederate force, a few brigades under Shanks Evans and Barnard B., who, acting on Alexander's tip, had hustled without orders west from the banks of Bull Run. McDowell's tactic had worked splendidly. He'd gotten there first with the most men. Now those men turned south, out onto the open ground of Matthews Hill, where they found South Carolina Colonel Nathan Shanks Evans and 900 Confederates waiting for them. Even among an officer corps conspicuous for its striking, flamboyant, and eccentric characters, Evans stood out. He got the nickname Shanks at West Point for having extremely skinny legs, though that name might have been the only thing that suggested any relationship with that elite educational institution. Evans, an odd-looking man with a high, wide forehead and penetrating light blue eyes, was crude, gruff, insubordinate, and profane. He was a braggart, too, especially when he was drinking, which was nearly all the time, an activity made possible by a Prussian orderly who followed him about, carrying a gallon jug of whiskey that Evans called his barrelita. But Evans was also a fearless fighter. He had positioned his small force directly in front of the Federal advance, and soon the battle exploded along a quarter-mile front. For an hour, he and his 900 Louisianans and South Carolinians battled numerically superior Federal forces to a standstill, an astonishing display of prowess for men who had never seen anything like this before and had never before heard the sickening thuds produced when 58 caliber bullets slammed into human flesh and human bone. Guns blazed from both lines as deafening noise and banks of dirty white smoke filled the air. Men fell, screaming. Some tried to take cover behind rocks or trees, but there was little cover anywhere. It was mostly an open fight. Two full Union brigades under Ambrose Burnside and Andrew Porter were brought against Evans, and still Evans repulsed them, even ordering a charge against a weak point in the Federal line by his 1st Louisiana Battalion, one of the more remarkable assemblages of soldiers in either army. They were an assortment of dock workers, stevedores, wharf rats, the lowest scum of the lower Mississippi who wore red fezes and blue-striped pantaloons, and under the command of Soldier of Fortune Robertdeau Wheat were some of the toughest fighters in the Confederacy. In the heat of the battle, some of Wheat's tigers, as they were known, dropped their guns and charged with bowie knives. Burnside was convinced that he was facing 6 regiments of infantry instead of the barely 2 he was fighting. But Evans could not hold his position much longer. Just as his men were falling back, a collection of Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi regiments, under the command of General B. and Colonel Francis Bartow, had arrived to reinforce him. B. was the beau ideal of the Southern officer, tall, strikingly handsome, and well-dressed. He'd been a mediocre and mischievous but highly popular cadet at West Point, and had compiled a glittering record in the Mexican-American and Seminole Wars. Bartow was a criminal lawyer from Savannah, Georgia, who had studied law at Yale. Like Evans, B. and Bartow had moved to the fighting without orders, and now they brought 2,800 fresh troops to help Evans in his desperate fight on Matthews Hill, giving the rebels about 3,700 men north of the Warrenton Pike. Still, that was less than half of the forces immediately ranged against them. Amid what one of his men called a perfect storm of shot and shell, B. now threw his men against the long blue line in front of him. Withering fire erupted from both sides, and the Federals raked the thin rebel lines with their artillery. At one point, seeking to flank the enemy, the 7th and 8th Georgia regiments occupied a thicket, which instead of offering cover, soon became a whirlwind of bullets, or as one of them called it, a place of slaughter. One company alone, usually 100 men, suffered 30 killed and wounded. The 8th Georgia suffered 200 casualties. It was soon apparent that the scanty Southern lines could not hold. At about 11:30, B., Bartow, and Evans, taking staggering casualties and surrounded by the enemy on 3 sides, retreated under heavy fire. As they were falling back, in great disorder and confusion, as they had no field officers left to rally them, said one of them, a third small Confederate force arrived on the scene. This time it was a collection of 600 South Carolinians, known as Hampton's Legion, outfitted and commanded by Wade Hampton, yet another exotic. A handsome man with flowing mustaches and long hair, and one of the wealthiest planters in the South, who had personally paid to outfit his men. Like Jackson, N.B. and Bartow before him, Hampton had been ordered to help Evans on the left, found that that particular left did not exist anymore, and had made a 3-hour march to the sound of the fighting. The Legion, which alone battled the Federal advance for nearly an hour, finally had to retreat too. By noon, the Federals had chased the last of the bleeding Confederates from Matthews Hill. The battle, which had lasted 2 hours, had been entirely the result of the initiative of a few rebel officers. The Confederate Army's top commanders had had nothing to do with it. They had not ordered the troop movements. They had not understood that the battle was going to take place on Matthews Hill and nearby Henry Hill and not where they had thought it would take place. All responsibility had passed to the brigadiers and colonels. They had seized the battle. They had fought with astounding ferocity and courage, and they had not broken, in spite of great odds, but were ultimately forced to retreat. On the top of Matthews Hill now stood an enormous mass of Federal troops, guns glittering in the midday sun. If McDowell had desired a final payoff for his plan, this was it. The flank march had worked. The rebels were in headlong retreat down Matthews Hill and up again toward the farmhouses on Henry Hill. His plan to have Tyler's forces from the Stone Bridge join the attack had worked, too. The arrival of their vanguard under their bright, aggressive commander, William Tecumseh Sherman, had helped put Bee, Bartow, and Evans to flight. McDowell needed only to throw a portion of his 18,000-man force forward, and the battle would soon be won. There was nothing to stop him. There was nothing of any military significance, in fact, between him and Manassas Junction. If he had thought hard about that, it meant that there was nothing much between his army and Richmond, either. Chapter 9 Scream of the Furies. What Jackson and his brigade saw when they emerged from the woods onto the top of Henry Hill, an open, gently swelling patch of land containing two homesteads, some fruit trees, and a small cornfield, was nothing less than a full-blown military disaster. There was absolutely no doubt about that, as there often was in the confusion of a battle. No room for misinterpretation, no sign of Confederate troops rallying or Yankees withdrawing, no dressing of gray-clad ranks, no pockets of stubborn resistance, no rebel field artillery moving resolutely forward to blast the Federals from the opposite hill. General Bee had not been exaggerating when he told Jackson that the enemy was driving his men. The scene stretching out in front of them was one of complete, bloody chaos. There was, moreover, no sign of any of the upper command anywhere. No evidence of Beauregard or Johnston or any of their staffs. There were just these few brave little brigades and pieces of brigades. Bees, Bartows, Evans, Hamptons, that had broken off from Beauregard's line and without orders had taken on the advancing Union Army. They had fought hard and even heroically, and had held off repeated, equally courageous Union assaults. But they had been greatly outnumbered and outgunned. "The wounded commenced passing us," recalled one of Jackson's soldiers. "Some with blood streaming down their faces, some with legs broken and hobbling along assisted by a comrade, and some seriously wounded and borne on stretchers." Jackson's former VMI student Charles Copeland White wrote, "As we approach the battleground, we meet men straggling off. They tell us that the enemy is in overwhelming numbers and that our men are in full retreat. Now the shells pass over us with their strange hissing sound, exploding in the thickets and cutting the limbs off trees." The scene was shocking, too, in its stark simplicity. In their immediate front, Jackson's men could see what was left of the Confederate forces, either streaming toward the rear or wandering forlornly, often officerless, around the two farmhouses atop Henry Hill. At the same time, the Virginians could look a mere mile across open fields to Matthews Hill and Dogan's Ridge to see the heart-stopping reason why. An enormous blue mass of soldiers, thick as wheat in the field, their bayonets flashing like silver in the noonday sun, their splendid batteries throwing flame and firing round after thunderous round, which were weirdly visible to the naked eye, at the retreating men. Having driven their enemies from the hill, the Federals now appeared to be massing for another assault that would drive them clear back to Manassas Junction. There was nothing to stop them. That would have been the assumption of anyone who saw the field of battle at noon. That is why what happened next was so remarkable. Jackson's reaction to the alarm in Bee's voice said everything about his approach to the crisis. If McDowell's splendidly equipped legions were cutting everyone and everything in their path to pieces, Jackson would simply give them the bayonet. The notion was quaintly old-fashioned, Napoleonic, in fact, though the point of it was clear. A bayonet was an intimate and intensely personal way to kill someone. Jackson meant business. His first concern was not whether he should retreat along with the others, or how he could get Johnston or Beauregard to send him reinforcements, or how 2,600 men with a few cannons were going to stop the federal juggernaut that had just driven more than 4,000 men from the field. His reaction was instinctive. Fight. Fight now. Hold the line. Jackson, riding at the head of his column, which extended four abreast into the woods behind him, now met another distressed Confederate officer. This was John D. Imboden, a lawyer from Stanton, Virginia, who from his position on the slope in front of Henry Hill had waged a remarkably brave one-battery duel with four small six-pounder guns against the assembled federal artillery. But his three remaining guns were almost out of ammunition, and many of his horses had been killed, so he too was retreating. Imboden, less scared than furious at General B. for having left him alone for so long on Henry Hill, gave Jackson a bitter, invective-laced account of what had just happened. B. had actually ordered him to withdraw 45 minutes before, but the messenger had died en route to him. Jackson seemed, oddly, more distressed by Imboden's choice of vocabulary than by the federal shells crashing around him. Imboden recalled, "I expressed myself with some profanity, which I could see was displeasing to Jackson." Jackson then told him, "Unlimber right here, I'll support your battery." A limber was a two-wheeled, horse-drawn wagon to which a cannon was attached for transport and also carried ammunition. Unlimbering meant detaching the cannon for action. A Civil War battery was a large operation, usually consisting of 4 to 6 cannons, each of which was drawn by 6 horses, and accompanied by as many as 6 ammunition wagons, caissons, also drawn by 6 horses each, plus several other supply wagons. A single battery might thus include 100 men and 72 or more horses. Imboden protested that he had only 3 rounds left and suggested that he move to the rear to resupply. But Jackson, anticipating the swarm of bluecoats that was likely to be coming at him and having no artillery yet in front, wanted at least the appearance of firepower. "No, not now," he told Imboden. "Wait till the other guns get here, and then you can withdraw your battery." Jackson now selected his defensive position. What he chose, quickly and under heavy artillery fire, was deeply unorthodox. Almost any other general would have made the textbook move forward to the northern edge of Henry Hill, the nominal high ground from which his guns and infantry would have looked down the slope to the Warrenton Pike, across which the Union soldiers would have to come. But Jackson instead chose the far southeastern edge of the plateau, the reverse slope, to place his infantry and artillery. As would soon become apparent, it was a brilliant tactical ploy. First, though the top of Henry Hill was largely an open field, this side of it was thick with pine trees. Jackson's men could set up there, unseen by the Federals with their deadly rifled guns on Matthews Hill. There were also trees to give the Virginians at least some protection from artillery fire. Even better, Jackson's own cannons would be able to roll forward over the lip of the hill, fire, then be carried back to safety by the recoil onto the downward slope, making them hard to see, too. Finally, this position offered Jackson a wide and largely unobstructed field of fire. Union troops cresting the northern side of Henry Hill would now have to cross 300 murderous yards of open ground to get to him. With his plan in mind, Jackson now went to work. Roving back and forth on horseback while enemy shells filled the air around him with lead and iron, he brought his artillery forward and carefully packed the woods in his center and on both flanks with his 5 regiments, the 2nd, 4th, 5th, 27th, and 33rd of Virginia. As he was doing this, Beauregard and Johnston, having at length concluded that the battle was not where they thought it was going to be, and that Ewell was never going to advance, finally arrived at the scene of the real fight. They took charge immediately. Johnston would soon agree to Beauregard's request to give him command of the battlefield, while Johnston assumed overall command from a farmhouse in the rear of Henry Hill. They immediately saw the logic of Jackson's unusual position and moved to reinforce him. Jackson's brigade was suddenly the center of the entire Confederate army, the very heart of the battle. Beauregard would build his new strategy around Jackson. One of the first things